This is episode 2. Welcome to our podcast. And this one is called Why Should We Care About the U.S.-Japan-Philippines Trilateral Summit? Jim, we have a summit coming up next week, and it's kind of a unique one. We've got President Marcos is coming from Manila. We've got Prime Minister Kishida coming from Tokyo. And there's going to be, after a state visit for Prime Minister Kishida, there's going to be a summit between all three countries on Thursday. So you asked me during our last podcast about this shift from a hub and spoke alliance system to this new sort of mesh network of alliances and whether I thought it was a good thing. And here we are. We're talking about a trilateral. And we've got two great guests today. We've got, I'll start by introducing somebody you introduced me to in the first place, Jim, and that's Dindo Manhit. Victor Manhit, founder and managing director of the Strat-Based Group, also the president of its policy think tank, the Albert Del Rosario Institute for Strategic and International Studies. Just a disclaimer, with my Sea Light hat on, I do a lot of work with Dindo and Strat-Based in the Philippines. So he has been very good to helping us get visibility there, and I'm very grateful for his partnership. Dindo, how are you?
I'm good, Ray. Thanks for inviting me here.
Thanks for getting up on a Saturday morning.
Yes. For you guys, I'll wake up anytime or stay late. Well,
that's very kind of you. And Jim, I'll turn it over to you to introduce our other guest.
All right. We got Chris Johnstone with us out of Washington, D.C., where he is at home right now. Chris is the Japan chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. For that, 25 years as a U.S. government weenie, like me. Started off at CIA, then went to DOD, and then spent some time at the National Security Council. Always a East Asia guy, especially Japan. Whenever I had a question about Japan, I knew I could go to Chris as one of the chiefs of the Chrysanthemum Club, as we used to call it. So we're going to start with you, Chris. Why should anyone listening to this care about this trilateral? It's, you know, Philippines, we're already a treaty ally. Japan, already a treaty ally. What difference does this make?
It makes a difference because it demonstrates that the U.S. is not alone in being increasingly concerned about the China problem. The U.S. and Japan have been getting closer for some time. The relationship under Prime Minister Abe deepened significantly in the 2010s, accelerated once Prime Minister Kishida took over, big increases in defense spending and so on. But in recent years, the relationship between the United States and the Philippines was more challenging, as I think Dindo might agree. During the Duterte years, it was quite difficult. I was in the Pentagon at a time when President Duterte announced that he was going to terminate the visiting forces agreement. And so the alliance in practical terms was on the verge of collapse in those days. And here we are just 3-4 years later, and we have these three leaders meeting together at the White House. It's a remarkable turn of events. Why is it happening, right? I mean, why all of a sudden are U.S. allies and partners not only getting closer with the United States, but getting closer with each other? It's not because the U.S. has some magical pixie dust that it sprinkles on its friends under President Biden and suddenly we're all working together. It's because we have converging interests and converging concerns about what's happening in the region. And I fully expect that there won't be a lot of public talk about China coming out of this trilateral meeting, but I think we would probably all agree that it's very much in the backdrop and a motivator here, even though we also have other reasons to collaborate as well. So that's why it matters.
All right. That's why it matters. Dindo, your turn. Why does it matter that we're getting these three countries together? Why should we care?
It really matters, especially if you look at it from a Philippine perspective. We had this thinking during the previous administration, the Duterte administration, that the Philippines is simply alone. As we try to assert our maritime rights, as we try to step up on our protecting our territorial integrity. But we knew prior to the previous government of Duterte that there are coalitions that wanted us to really deal with our aggressive, coercive northern neighbor, China, from a international perspective. That's why we filed the case. After the filing of the case, now, 6 years after our victory, we have a president who listened to the Filipino people. When you have 9 out of 10 Filipinos telling the new president, you need to assert our rights. We are not happy where we are. But still, when you see the commitment of countries, and that is what we'll be seeing next week, US and Japan, to stand with us, to work with us, and hopefully not only at the level of national security, but also in the economic front also. Then it makes ourselves stronger in this part of the region. And in the Philippines also, the top of mind is Japan, the US, and you add Australia, are the top 3 countries that we trust, we respect. So this is very positive initiative with President Biden hosting them in Washington, D.C.
So, Chris, what does Japan get out of this new relationship? How do they envision this working?
Yeah, so I think for Japan, I mean, a few things. I think Japan has always considered the Philippines a priority partner in Southeast Asia. I mean, even during the Duterte years, when things were difficult between the United States and the Philippines, with Prime Minister Abe and President Duterte, relations were pretty good. And they made a lot of concrete progress together. And I think in some ways, Abe helped the United States to keep the lights on in the relationship with the Philippines, I would argue. So this focus on the Philippines for Japan is not necessarily new. I think for Japan, right, Japan sees a deep connection between the territorial issues they're dealing with in the East China Sea and what the Philippines and other South China Sea claimants are dealing with in the South China Sea. It's one maritime domain for Japan that sits astride really important sea lines of communication. So for Japan, the relationship with the Philippines, the relationship with Vietnam, the relationship with Indonesia, these are the top priority relationships in Southeast Asia. And I think with the Philippines, you know, there's also this, I think, a sense of common values, too, the history of democracy. Dindo can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think my sense is, you know, that the Philippines was among the first to become more comfortable with a larger Japanese security role, certainly ahead of some others in Southeast Asia. And I think that's the other remarkable thing here, right? How the Philippines and others in Southeast Asia are welcoming Japan as a security provider, given that history. So there's a lot of symbolism attached to this, which is really interesting. And I think really positive for the overall picture from the U.S. perspective.
Before we go over to Dindo, I do have a follow-up for you, Chris, and that's, you know, with respect to what we're looking at with these joint patrols now. Now it's gone from joint with the U.S. to trilateral patrol. Now it looks like it's going to be a quadrilateral patrol with Australia in the South China Sea. Why is this happening now?
Well, again, I think it's happening now because there is this convergence of shared concern over the security environment. There's been some of this activity before, but the pace of it, and it's not just Southeast Asia, right? I mean, you see it with the U.S., Japan, and the ROK, the Japan-Australia connection by itself. I mean, there's just this growing, I think, set of linkages, some of which involve the United States, but some of which don't, right? I mean, I think also in the background here, I think, I would posit, you know, in a time when there are questions about the future of U.S. power in the region, maybe it's not surprising that you see partners strengthening ties with each other, with those who they think share common perspectives on things. So I think that's very much in the backdrop of Japan's focus on the Philippines, on Australia, on a few others as well.
And Dindo, when you look at this new relationship between Japan and the Philippines, how much do you think the Philippine military is going to look to Japan for military assistance or leadership or coordination? Is it a diminution of U.S. Philippines military relationship, or is it somehow going to be a trilateral? How do you think this is going to work?
I see it really as a trilateral. On the part of the Philippines, you know, we have really seen value in keeping a strong relationship with the U.S. military. With Japan, they've been consistent, but in a limited way because, of course, their own constitutional limitation in the past. But they've been quite active in providing us support in our own coastal watch, coast guards. And now they're ready to step up, especially as we move towards a possible treaty, strategic partnership with them that they call Reciprocal Access Agreement. Hopefully it moves faster than what we can imagine. But that one, we see it as, for the Philippine perspective, is countries that share our values, that believe on a rules-based order in protecting our seas, the West Philippine Sea with the rest of Southeast Asia, will always be a good basis of support for the Philippine military. I was with the leadership of our own armed forces just 2 days ago, because I've been appointed as a private sector advisor to the military last December, but sworn in this week. And you see how important these alliances, these partnerships with them. And there's really a lot of positiveness. And the good thing is there's public support. So it's not limited to the military. It's not limited to the government, but there's public support. I was just talking to one of the big conglomerates yesterday, and they were asking me about this. And 2 days ago, also another one of those big conglomerates, and they're saying they're quite happy with this direction. And these are some of these conglomerates are Filipino-Chinese in terms of descent, but they see themselves as Filipinos. This is good for us. Japan, the U.S., our president traveling to Washington next week. So they just hope that it really leads to actual commitment, that we don't get drawn into something that we might be left behind in the future.
So I'm going to ask you, so last year, starting in February, the Philippines began to release pictures. And in fact, again, back to full transparency, I co-authored a piece for Dindo, for his strat-based consultancy, in January, basically talking about this as an assertive transparency campaign, where the pictures and the video are the centerpiece of the Philippines campaign, which has now been going on for over a year. And now, so we've all been treated to all of these really evocative images of water cannons and swarming and blocking and all of these gray zone actions that used to happen out of sight, but all of a sudden the lights are on and everybody can see what Chinese ships have been doing to Philippine ships in the West Philippine Sea. And so, as a long setup, and a bit of a leading question here, do you think that this trilateral would have happened had not we all been sort of had these ringside seats to all of this drama happening over the last year?
I think it definitely added impetus to it, Ray. And I would just say, you know, it's really brave of the Philippines to do this, right? To sort of publicize day after day what's been going on in the South China Sea. And it hasn't yet changed Chinese behavior, at least as far as I can tell. Maybe others here feel differently. But it's what it's done is, I think, generate a lot of sympathy and support for the Philippines. Now, my own view is that there are, you know, other members of ASEAN should be a bit more vocal in speaking out on behalf of their ASEAN comrade. So that's been a little disappointing to me, but my understanding is under the surface, there's deeper dialogue between the Philippines and Indonesia, with Vietnam and others about sort of coordinating responses to all this. But maybe Dindo, you might be able to talk a bit about that. So I do think, you know, it's the courage of Marcos and his team to stand up to this and to rebuild the alliance with the United States and to reach out to other partners like Japan that, you know, resulted in this meeting. And it's great. I hope it's more than just a one-time meeting. I hope it sets in motion a real sort of institutionalized process of dialogue and cooperation. My understanding is there are going to be a whole number of defense-related things that are announced, as well as some non-defense areas of cooperation too, like on critical minerals and some other areas.
But you don't expect a secretariat or any permanent standing organizing group, do you?
No, not certainly not yet. Maybe eventually. But one thing, Dindo, I wanted to sort of ask you, you know, the Philippine ambassador to the United States the other day, just this week, gave an on the record interview in which he said that Japanese military units may begin to rotate through the Philippines, at least implying a sort of periodic presence of Japanese military forces. Is that something you've heard as well? I was certainly anticipating the patrols, the exercises. I was not necessarily anticipating a more routinized presence on the ground, if you will.
That's the one that I was referring to Chris earlier about the random or regular access agreement, as they call it. But it needs the approval of our own legislature. But there's full support by the legislature. I was talking to the leadership of our Senate, and they said, it's making it easy for us to generate at least 3/4 vote because of what's happening. Yeah. And thank you for that assertive transparency, Ray, because it helped our own legislature. We just don't know when it will happen. They say it's happening this year. So the moment it's approved, there will be constitutional and legal basis for this rotation of Japanese forces.
Yeah, okay.
You referred to Ambassador Romulda's interview, and he talked there that there are a lot of other options we may take. What do you think he was referring to?
I don't know, actually. go ahead. Sorry, you're talking to Dindo? Yeah, let Dindo answer.
Chris?
No, go ahead, Dindo. You know better than I do.
I think with Ambassador Romulda is an old friend of mine and actually part of our Strat-Based Institute when we were starting. It's really, he likes floating these things when it's normally just for discussion purpose. But he has done very well in playing this game because it pushed really the policy direction faster. So it could be conversations about joint patrols in terms of really finding or institutionalizing how to move around the West Philippine Sea with these two trilateral partners, if I would call it, Japan and the U.S. Because what has been happening is that, of course, everybody sees what's happening in West Philippine Sea, but the question, especially those that are funded by China in the countries, so we are still left alone here. We're alone. So maybe Ambassador Romualdez is saying that it's through this trilateral, we can see an active joint patrol cup with the U.S., with Japan. And I think he even added the word Australia because that's also that discussion happening in country. So I'm hoping that we really see action. So not simple piece of paper, as some would say, operation agreements, discussion point, but actual action. So
Chris, we see a lot, you know, there's the, having spent time in the region, what everybody wants from the U.S., yeah, sure, it's security, but they also want access to our markets. And we've been pretty stingy about that as a country in recent years. And it doesn't look like it's going to get any easier anytime soon. The conversation still sort of bends in this very protectionist direction. Is there any hope that anything could emerge from this summit that might at least turn on some of the spigots so that there could be a little more economic incentive for these countries to work with us?
I mean, I think in minor ways, maybe, Ray. I mean, we'll see what comes of these critical minerals and other supply chain related issues that they're working on and how much specificity and incentivizing there is behind them. But look, I mean, I think it'd be fair to say that this is the built-in contradiction of the current Biden administration's foreign policy, right? On the one hand, you've got a very heavy emphasis on alliances, which is genuine and has produced real results, including this meeting. On the other hand, I think it's also fair to say you've got a real retreat from engagement on international economic issues, including trade, right? So there's no prospect of the U.S. coming back to CPTPP. The IPEF trade pillar, of course, blew up at the last minute in November. Some possibility it'll get resuscitated in the second Biden term, but we'll see. And, you know, from a Japanese perspective, the swirl around the Nippon Steel proposed acquisition of U.S. Steel, which, frankly, in my view, is pretty outrageous, the administration's response to that. So I do think it's important to be candid about the contradictions in the policy and the weaknesses in the policy. I mean, I think that's where Japan's role becomes important, because Japan can compensate for some of the weaknesses that we have in our own approach. Japan has, ironically, if you remember the 80s and 90s, become the leader of high standard free trade agreements, multilateral free trade agreements in the region. They still have economic statecraft tools that are very significant for development assistance, loans through the Japan Bank of International Cooperation. So they have a lot of resources and tools that they can bring to the table that I think help address really what are many of the priorities for countries in Southeast Asia, which are focused first and foremost on their own development. So in that sense, there's a complementarity between what the U.S. and Japan offer. But I think it's fair to say that it's unfortunate where the U.S. is these days when it comes to trade and economic policy.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that, Chris. But for Dindo, China disappointed the Duterte regime by not investing in infrastructure as they promised. But Philippine infrastructure needs, especially on things like a natural gas regasification facility, is pretty critical. Is there an opportunity for Japan, maybe leading with U.S. support, to help finance some of this infrastructure and get Philippines moving that way?
You know, in the Philippines, when the former President Duterte tried to push with China, the question really was, do we need those loans and ODA? Because the private sector and their consortiums were ready to build those infrastructures. And this is where we are now. Even in the gas facilities, private sector is building it. I know Japan private company is working with a Filipino energy company also. Where we need presence maybe is also in oil and gas exploration, because there are a lot of geological findings that could be very helpful for us. But in terms of LNG terminal, in terms of infrastructure space, what the government, our government, President Marcos' government now is saying that we're open. There are probable consortiums. There are probable investments. Even Scandinavian countries are looking at offshore wind. They have really invested on time and effort to go through the regulatory process, and they're moving forward. So there's this a lot of initiatives coming from countries, and we need the U.S. Actually, we don't hear of the U.S. That's why that's the contradiction here. What we have a lot of U.S. companies here in the country, but they've been around for over a century already. But in these new areas, U.S. is not in mineral extraction. U.S. is not into infrastructure. So that's where the question is. But it's good that other friends of the Philippines are stepping up on this thing. We see Japan, Korea has always been trying to be active in the infrastructure space. Again, as I've said, EU countries. So,
Can I ask you a follow-up question on that? So in Manila, there are factions, of course, right? And you've sort of got the faction, you've got the growing sort of chasm between the Marcos presidency and the Duterte former presidency and vice presidency. You've also got the internal Marcos on one side and his own sister on the other side, you know, sort of advocating more of a pro-Beijing stance. How serious is this sort of tension in Manila over how to approach China and the United States? And related to that, does Bongbong Marcos need to really walk out of this meeting with some deliverables he can go home and tell the people about?
That noise coming from the sister, who actually does not matter in this country, but it's just that, you know, when you have a Marcos name and you're an elected senator of the Philippines, and quite sad in our Senate, when you're given the Foreign Affairs Committee, that's the least influential politically. So it was given to her. So it gave her a platform. On the part of the Duterte, if there's a choice between Marcos and Duterte, you might see Duterte in the next few months really losing out. Because, you know, the incumbency, you don't fight City Hall. Then you add the popular support for standing up against China. That's why even the allies of President Duterte are saying things differently in local media channels. But it would be very good if the president comes out of this trilateral with strong commitments, with actual next steps. And those next steps take the form of things happening really in our country, or things, or in terms of the president has all used this a year ago, I remember. National security is economic security. I mean, bringing some agreements that will deal with supply chain possibilities of us being part of the supply chain of semiconductors, because we do that little in a small part. You know? But imagine if we can really broaden that, if there's really an opportunity for exploring critical minerals in country with investments coming from the US, because Japan has played that game already in terms of the nickel extraction. So we need that actual deliverables, because that gives us more strength as we counter-argue the 24/7 disinformation being funded by China. When they say they're the most important trading partner in the Philippines, I always counter, we import more, but we don't export. So that's not beneficial trade partnership. When they say they are ready to invest, we said, I always say 0.9% during the time of Duterte. So you have to counter that. But that's their job 24/7. In my case, I have to do other things. So, but some people start believing it when it keeps being repeated by bloggers. You know, we are, 75, 78 million Filipinos are, or nearly 80 million are into social media. So it's good to have Marcos saying these things after that trip. I came with a commitment coming from the U.S. Mm-hmm. with Japan, stronger economic ties, stronger defense ties, and we see them acting in the next few months. That's the headline that I'd like to see.
So on a related question, Chris, is there any pushback within the LDP or from the opposition against this idea of strengthening security ties with another country, given especially Japan's pacifist history?
Yeah, surprisingly, no. Some aspects of Japan's defense buildup have been a little controversial. Somewhat surprisingly, the most controversial has been the part of their agenda that's focused on strengthening their own defense industry and enabling it to export stuff overseas. That was more controversial than, say, for example, the decision to acquire Tomahawk cruise missiles, which is a little counterintuitive. I think we're in a new day in Japan. I think, of course, the North Korea challenge has been there for a long time. In some ways, the China challenge isn't new for Japan. I would argue they were ahead of the curve in terms of where we were in recognizing what China was becoming. But what changed everything politically from a public opinion standpoint was the war in Ukraine and then Beijing's decision to support Moscow. That was had a transformative impact, and you saw it in the polls on views of security issues, views of defense spending. So this stuff is not controversial. Now, if we were to begin to see like proposals for long-term stationing of Japanese forces overseas, that sort of thing might become more controversial. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about more regular Japanese presence in the Philippines for training activities, joint patrols, exercises. And I think there's strong support for that.
So, Jim, I'm going to ask you this question because, of course, as we mentioned before, this trilateral patrol that we've all been talking about for a couple of weeks now is going to be a quadrilateral patrol. And so Australia is joining in, and I think that there's been some question recently, even in Australian media, about how the Albanese government there is approaching China. Do you read anything into their decision to join this patrol, or is this just sort of, is this kind of within the range of what you might expect?
Well, I think what we've seen is a steadily focus of this administration on the region. You know, they declined to join the naval group dealing with the problems with the Houthis in Yemen, arguing basically that we're going to stick to our region. That's where we're going to put our resources. So that's one. Two, they already have joint patrols with the Philippines as it is, and they're looking to do additional joint patrols with other countries. So I think this was a bit of a no-brainer. They have an increasingly strong mil relationship with Japan, as Chris can tell you. They recently signed a status of forces agreement, allowing Australian troops to visit Japan. So it's the same trajectory. I'd be interested if Chris sees anything unusual from the Japanese perspective about Australia joining in sort of at the last minute for something that's not even announced yet. I don't know. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I don't have any insight about the dynamics around this particular event. It just as you said, Jim, the Japan-Australia relationship is really good, and it's gotten dramatically better. I don't know what the dynamics were around this. There have been other multilateral patrols, of course, this one more significant, I guess. But I just don't know what the actual background was.
What do you think? Is this more significant?
Yeah, it's very significant. From our perspective, we've always had this visiting forces, or what we call officially status of forces agreement with Australia. But of course, people will always say, is Australia really willing to commit themselves? But you see them working with two other countries, quadrilateral, that makes it stronger narrative. But something that might not be being monitored from your end, we've seen even Canada trying to commit to it. The president traveled to Germany and are engaging EU countries. So you see a broadening support for some of this, maybe initially joint exercise, being part of joint exercises, but hopefully it moves towards joint patrol like this quadrilateral. But it's a way to deter maybe more actions by China, aggressive actions in our part of the region.
That opens up the big can of worms that maybe we can sort of close out on and just sort of ask everyone your opinion on this question, which is, does any of this deter Beijing? As we've all noted, the excitement around Second Thomas Shoal since last year has not gone down. There has only been an increase in Chinese aggression. All of the assertive transparency, all of the pictures and video, they've gone the other way. They've decided to try to out-escalate the Philippines. So does all of this international support, all of these things seem like a positive, and yet next month the Philippines is going to have to go out and resupply that ship again, and there's no reason at this point to think that they won't once again be faced with water cannons. Can any of this deter China?
I see it different, Ray, because is anyone doing joint patrol with us in Ayungin Shoal, Second Tom? None. No one yet. So it's basically what we hear, and this is what China is looking at maybe, is that a lot of statement of support, but no actual action. So if we see actual action with this trilateral, with this quadrilateral, that could deter China, maybe.
Well, so let me ask you this, and you use the term Ayungin Shoal, which of course is the Filipino term for Second Thomas Shoal.
Second Thomas Shoal, yeah.
But President Marcos has not asked, I don't think, for joint patrols at Second Thomas Shoal.
That's what we need to put pressure on our government. And I think that's one of their discussions now, going to this trilateral.
Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, it's of course the fundamental question, right? What deters China? Look, I think all these things are a piece of the puzzle. So I think when you add up, I think no one thing is the magic bullet, but collectively maybe they make a difference, right? I mean, when you think about, start with Japan's defense buildup, what Australia is doing with AUKUS submarines, the growing minilateralism in the region, the rise of the Quad, all of these things together send the message, or at least raise the question in Beijing, that if they pick a real fight, they may have a big fight on their hands, right? That their ability to isolate potential opponents is declining because the region is coming together in some form. I don't want to overstate it, but I think the trend lines are very clear, right? I mean, I first put the term a network security architecture into a slide deck at DoD around 2012, and it didn't really mean much back then. It was a lot of lip service to these trilaterals and new things. There are real agendas behind U.S. Japan are okay. I mean, read that Camp David joint declaration between the U.S. Among U.S., Japan, Australia. I mean, that is a real meaty, a lot of it classified agenda. And I think I would expect that the U.S., Japan, Philippines trilateral will move in the same direction. So this is real. Something is happening in the region, right? And I do believe collectively that it can make a difference. Is it decisive? I mean, China decides it's going to invade Taiwan, then there's not much any of us can do to prevent that. But on the margins, I think it matters.
All right, Jim, I give you the last word. Is this going to deter China, or are we sliding down a slope?
Well, it just fascinates me that China keeps insisting that they're all for peace and security and everyone getting along, kumbaya. And yet we see all these changes over the past few years because of China's aggression. And China keeps insisting, it's not us, it's you, man. Yeah. So they're on their trajectory and we're all reacting. But it's good we're reacting. And the trick is to find the balance between deterrence and forcing China's hand. So that's where Chris and Dindo will handle that.
All right. Well, you guys get right on that, would you? Frankly, it's been out of control, and you guys obviously have been sleeping too much. So, you know, I'm glad we've been able to keep you up late tonight, Chris, and get you up early, Dindo, so that you guys can get back on this. Hey, thanks all of you for a really great discussion. This has really been interesting. I look forward to seeing what happens on the 11th. Hopefully, it exceeds all of our expectations and hopes and dreams. I also want to thank my co-host, Jim Caruso, and this has been an exciting journey together in this new endeavor with this podcast. Thank you to our listeners, both of you. We invite you to subscribe and, of course, to give us a 5-star review. If you don't want to give us a 5-star review, then forget I said anything. For Jim Caruso, I'm Ray Powell, and this has been Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Thanks very much.